Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brady McCartney, your host today. I'm honored to be joined by Gavin Van Horn, co-editor, along with Robin Walkimer and John Hausdorfer of Kinship, Belonging in a World of Relations, published in 2021 by the Center for Humans and Nature. Gavin is the creative director and executive editor of the Center for Humans and Nature. Gavin Van Horn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brady.
All right. So to start, if you could just tell us a bit about yourself, your background, the work of the Center for Humans and Nature, and how you became interested in this topic.
Sure thing. So, my background intersects with yours in a way, Brady. We were both in the Religion and Nature program at the University of Florida, me much longer ago than you. But I have been working for the Center for Humans and Nature for a little over 11 years now, and it is an organization that's based in the Chicagoland area, and it has a focus on the environmental humanities, environmental ethics, and really about asking the big questions of what it means to relate and relate well to the more than human world. So it's really diving into these ethical questions that people may have about our relationship to the natural world, and it tries to create a platform that is a circle of conversation between experts and activists and artists, poets and writers, and so it's very interdisciplinary, even transdisciplinary by nature, and unlike academic institutions, it also really tries to be accessible. I often tell the people that I work with when I have my editorial hat on, people that contribute to our books, one of my first things to offer them is tell a good story. Because what we're trying to invite really from anybody that comes across our work is we're trying to engage their empathic imaginations to see themselves in the stories of others. And that doesn't just include human others, that includes our many, many non-human other kind that we share this planet with. Was there another part of the question that I didn't address?
Yeah, just so we're talking about Kinship. We are talking about a 5-volume series on kinship. So how did you become interested in this broad topic of kinship?
So I think for me, it began with an event. I'll go back a tiny bit further than that, because again, it connects a little bit to your story in that I first read a scholar named Graham Harvey, who wrote a book called Animism, in which he talks about the various animisms in the world, not just as a past artifact as something that is often framed in the religious context as a sort of something that's been sort of supplanted by monotheism or polytheism. You know, animism is kind of, in old scholarship and late 19th century scholar, maybe early 20th century as well, there was a kind of idea that there was a progression beyond animism, that animism was tied to indigenous cultures and they had all kinds of false beliefs and it worked for them at the time, but we've since moved beyond that. I'm, of course, generalizing a little bit here, but Harvey's efforts were to reclaim that term and that practice, that way of life, as something that was not something that was sort of archaic or quote unquote primitive, but actually a very viable way of interacting and engaging with the world, not only for indigenous persons, but for also in many, many modern movements. And one of the terms that he uses in his book, one of the things that he emphasizes that is characteristic of an animistic relationship to the world, is the idea that there are other than human persons in this world. So the concept or the category of personhood is much more expansive than simply being confined to human beings or to Homo sapiens. So persons is the larger umbrella that includes anything that we perceive as having agency, perhaps other than human intelligence, that has a will of its own, a wildness of its own, intention, that sometimes intersects with our interests as human beings, other times doesn't, but nonetheless needs to be honored and engaged with, as though the world is full of subjectivities and is not just a collection of objects. And so I think that larger framing of personhood really struck home with me, really something I identified with personally, and also something that kind of tweaked the lens with which I was viewing the way that other people interacted with the world. So that concept of personhood then became very powerful politically and legally when certain non-human entities began to receive legal rights as persons. And I'm thinking in particular here of something that happened quite recently, and that's in 2017, the Whanganui River in Aotearoa, New Zealand, was granted the rights of personhood that was legally designated a living entity to which the people of New Zealand and the Maori people that were the stewards of that watershed had particular responsibilities to make sure that it wasn't not only to make sure that it wasn't defiled, that it wasn't polluted, that it wasn't mistreated, but that it was honored and lived with in terms of a reciprocity, an entwining of cultural and ecological lifeways. So that a river could be a person went on. It wasn't the first time that that had happened, but it was a one that caught a lot of headlines and it intersected with a lot of thoughts that I'd been having about my work at the Center for Humans and Nature and what the next project was that I wanted to take on. So originally, the Kinship Project started out as thinking about, let's do a project on non-human persons or expanding that concept of personhood. But still, I think in the end, we felt maybe that's a little less accessible and maybe a broader way to talk about this is just to talk about it as kinship, the ways that we are related to non-human persons falls under that that rubric of kinship. And it gives us a lot of latitude to talk about these relationships that we share with other than human persons on all different scales. So it seemed like an exciting way to not just limit ourselves to say legal cases or, to particular examples, but to talk more broadly about the ways that we live in various kinships in this world, and to really emphasize the idea that humans are in the practice, that humans are not somehow divided from the natural world, apart from, that we are not categorically different. I think you'll know the kind of famous quote from Darwin that we are maybe different in degree, but not in kind as a species. In other words, there's continuity between us psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, perhaps even certainly cognitively, and between our own species and other species. And moreover, that it's not limited to just species. There are people in this in our book who talk about relationships to the moon as a person, relationship to mountains as people, relationship to entire bioregions. So it really can kind of blow the lid off of a kind of human chauvinism or human exclusivity, which I think most of us nowadays, not all of us, but a lot of us inherit as kind of fundamental to, let's just call it a Western industrialist worldview.
Right. And I think, as I heard you say in another interview, if the U.S. Supreme Court can grant corporations personhood, why not a river?
Well, the funny thing about that, of course, I think, is that, and not funny really, because, you know, the impacts of it can be devastating. But that idea that that would somehow be acceptable, but that you would leave a river off the table, you know, metaphorically speaking, I don't know how you can put a river on the table, but you know what I mean? In terms of personhood, it really shows where the social values lie and what our legal system is built to support. That is, you know, capital, or those things that can be defined with a monetary label, are accorded a kind of value that is almost sacred, you know, that if we're talking about something being defined as a person and having the rights of a person, you know, I think that's a reflection of where we are and how, if something can't be economically captured, then it somehow is of off the radar, or maybe just of lesser worth. So I think there is something significant about that fact.
Sure. And I don't mean to, you know, equate ecological processes or the natural world with a corporation. However, the Supreme Court may have unintentionally given folks a tool to assert personhood for non-human entities, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, we're still working all that out, and will be for some time, because, you know, of course, in our Western legal system, you know, land is viewed as either private property, public good, but in some way or another, somebody owns it. And whether that ownership includes a relationship that cares for it is a whole nother question. Most of the time, ownership simply means you can, let's call it extractivism, you can take whatever you want because you've bought title to that place. Your ethical responsibility to it is then only constrained by other laws, you know, say, you know, the Protection of Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, or the, you know, or something else. But this is, you know, it's constantly, there's this catching up between somebody, you know, a company, let's say, that's, you know, dumping waste product into a river, you know, the ability to do that usually comes first. The damage is done, and the protection only comes later. And again, to circle back to what we were talking about before, I think it's reflective of that idea that the earth lands, waters, airs are simply kind of common area into which you can, you don't have to have a relationship to it unless it's, you know, it's just one of a kind of cast off relationship, you know, consequences be damned. But there isn't an inherent reciprocity or kinship recognition there. So I think that's really the kinds of alternative stories that we're trying to hold up here, is that while that might be common, while that might be familiar to us, these books, this series of books, show that there are many, many alternative narratives that might have been suppressed, that might have been actively discarded or tamped down, but they're out there. These stories are there, these different ways of being, these different ways of being kin and honoring the other living persons that we share this world with.
All right. So before we go any further, we should probably define a couple of key terms. So we've used kinship a fair amount, a term we haven't yet used, kinning. So maybe you could define those two and then describe perhaps an experience you've had where that you would describe as kinning.
So first with kinship, I mean, it is what it sounds like, that we are related. We are relatives as earthlings with other earthlings. And I think that maybe the common way of thinking about kinship, just this sort of, let's call it conventional or familiar way, that probably most people think of kinship, is they usually just think of their immediate families or maybe their extended families. Like, oh, my second cousin is, I'm kin, you know. What we're saying is that, no, it's not just a matter of immediate genetic relations. That kinship is, I've mentioned the word more than a few times, I'm sure I will more than a few more. And, you know, the subtitle of the book is Belonging in a World of Relations, right? So we're talking about a kinship that it can be based on, you know, sort of genetic, you know, relations. For instance, you know, this, you know, we know that we shared 99%+ of our DNA with chimpanzees, for instance, or as my son reminded me the other day, we share 70% of our genetics with a banana. There is a genetic component, but that's so limiting, that kind of biological DNA code. We want to say that relations are built on relating, right? So what is the quality of our relationships with other species and other and the landscapes that we're a part of? So that leads me right into, I think, the idea of kinning, which is a verb. You know, we're talking about we are kinning with the world around us. That's just a way of emphasizing that this is a practice. This is something that that we do through various ways, that we build our relationships over time. And, you know, anyone will know the sort of analog, you know, when we think about our most intimate relationships, like if we're in a long-term partnership or a marriage, you know, things are much different 20, 25, 30 years down the line than they are when we first start, you know, first see somebody from across a room, right? And so these relationships are built over time. And that's, means time spent intentionally with others, and there are all different kinds of practices. In fact, volume 5 of the series is entitled Practice, because we wanted to offer up some of the ways that various people find that they can that these practices of connection that they participate in, and the ways that we can begin to sort of break through that idea that the world around us is just a scenery or a kind of a stage set for human action, you know, a play, a of some kind that we're just walking through. And then, you know, no, these are living energies, living entities, that living subjectivities that we are in the midst of. So how can we become better kin, I think, is a really strong question that runs throughout the series.
I would agree. I think that is one of the core questions. So as you mentioned, as I've mentioned, this is a 5-volume series. This is a very ambitious work. You've divided the volumes into planet, place, partners, persons, and practice. Obviously, a lot of P words, some alliteration, perhaps. but maybe you could explain the significance of these categories. Like, why did you choose them? Were there alternatives you considered? I assume these were pretty intentional choices.
Yeah, they were. And it emerged kind of organically. I mean, the idea that we connect as kin at different scales is there to begin with. And what I mean by scales, I mean, you know, from the macro to the micro, right? So from the cosmic, you know, in the sense that, you know, as Joni Mitchell said, we are stardust, right? Or Carl Sagan probably said it first. I don't know if he did, actually. Maybe he did.
We can give them both credit, you know.
We can give them both credit.
Worthy of credit for a variety
of
reasons.
That's right. Yeah. One in a more poetic way, you know. But you know, this idea that we are of the same elements, you know, that we're of the same stuff, you know, let's start there. Like this, you know, the notion that we're so divided or we're so different as human beings from other forms of life, you know. So let's start with the macro. Let's look at the ways that, you know, we're influenced by, that we're, you know, at least on this planet, we share a sun, we share an atmosphere, we share, you know, a night sky. What are the ways in which, you know, on that sort of scale, we can consider ourselves kin? And then from there, from the macro, we sort of went step down a level for each volume. You know, we have place, and that's the bioregions, the watersheds that we find ourselves a part of. Very important to giving to informing us about what we're related to and how our regions affect us. And then we went down a scale or down a step into partners, these interspecies relationships, these relationships that we have with other of our fellow earthlings. And then from there to persons, really getting into kind of the, both the human psychology of, but also, you know, acknowledging the particularity, like we're not equally kin with all other creatures. There are some creatures that we have very special and particular relationships with. And that goes for whole cultures who, you know, if you think about totem species or you think about cultural touchstones, species that are in the mythology or the origin stories, the cosmologies of indigenous folks or non-indigenous folks for that matter. But also on a personal level, like we might develop a relationship with a particular species, even an individual in a particular species, say a crow that comes to visit our, you know, balcony. And that's an important scale to consider, because in some ways those are in some ways the least abstract, you know, and potentially the most meaningful and inform how we view other species, outside of that individual. And then the practice volume is really a way to bring it down. If we, you know, started with the cosmic, then to say, you know, well, what happens with our feet and our hands, you know, where does our skin meet the earth's skin? And how do we cultivate these relationships more intentionally? But you asked, like, were these there from the beginning? And they weren't there from the beginning, because at the beginning, we just thought we were going to do one volume on kinship. We just thought, you know, we'll get together, you know, say 20 or so contributors, maybe a couple more, and we'll do this volume on kinship. And over time, you know, Robin Wall Kimmerer and John Hausdorfer as my co-editors, they brought people into the mix. I continue to reach out to people. The people I reached out to put me in touch with other people. You know, a lot of our poetry came from that kind of organic process where somebody just said, you know, who you should really get in touch with is so-and-so. And over time, we developed this body of material that then, you know, I hate to make it sound like it just all just completely like, you know, all the jigsaw pieces locked into place. But there was really a sense of like, well, this essay goes here, this poem goes here, this, you know, and then they all flow into one another, and they really divided themselves out fairly equally between these different categories, you know, planet, place, partners, persons, practice. So I'm really grateful for the way that it came out like that. And then we thought, well, we already have this material, so let's bundle it together and put it out there in that form.
Yes. Well, quite a few contributors, as you said, poets, scientists, scholars of all backgrounds, novelists, Richard Powers, of course, worth sure. mentioning that you have him, but also our current poet laureate, Joy Harjo. So yeah, quite a few people who I think are entry points for lots of different kinds of readers, maybe folks who might not be as familiar with some of the academic literature, and that's just fine because the poetry stands out as much as anything. So well done in presenting, I think, many different takes on kinship. You mentioned Robin Wall Kimmerer, obviously one of your co-editors. So central to this book is this notion of ki that she brings up in her essay. I think you bring it up in your intro essay. And also Enrique Salmon's notion of concentric ecology. Could you just describe those two concepts, those two notions, and why they were important sort of connective threads within, I think, all five volumes?
Yeah, absolutely. So Robin wrote a piece that appeared in Orion magazine, but I think it also, I don't know if it originally appeared in Braiding Sweetgrass or if it was the other way around, but it's a chapter called The Grammar of Animacy. And in that, she talks about how in her native Potawatomi language, there are a lot of things that in English are nouns, but in Anishinaabe are verbs. And so I can't think of, I'm going to get this example wrong, but, you know, say like we look out and we see, you know, a bay, a body of water, and we call it a bay. We, you know, it's a noun. It's just a body. There's another noun of water, another noun. And she said, well, no, in my language, that would be, and I'm making this up. You'll have to go back and read the essay for yourself. But it's something like, you know, the wind whips through the water, you know, or something like that. It has a much more active presence. So it's not a noun, it's a verb. It's moving. It's there's oftentimes intentionality buried in the words and the terms, the phrases that are used. Another good sort of touchstone for this would be Keith Basso's work, right? Wisdom Sits in Places. So this is not uncommon to indigenous languages. And so Robin proposes that one of the problems with the noun-heavy English language is its use of pronouns. That we often, you know, I won't put you on the spot, you know, but say you see a bird flying through the sky. You might turn to a friend and say, "Wow, look at that bird! Isn't that cool? What is it? Oh, well, I think it's a, you know, red-tailed hawk." You know, from here, that's what it seems like. Oh, is that what it is? Well, each time you're calling it an it, right? an it is our pronoun in the English language that, you know, usually describes an object. And it's very, very common for not just plants or you know, or landscapes or whatever. But, you know, for other non-human animals to be called it, you know. In fact, I probably think that's I'm assuming that's still, you know, the convention in almost all scientific work, right? I know from studying Mexican gray wolves that, you know, every wolf has a number that's reintroduced, you know, to keep track of them, you know, so they're M564, you know, and they're called it. And to give them, to call them he or she, even though it would be anatomically correct, is sort of frowned upon, because the idea is that, well, that makes them somehow, that would be either A, anthropomorphizing, which is a no-no, or, you know, that it makes it harder to do the job of managing them and probably, you know, and managing them up to the point of killing them if, you know, if necessary. So if you call something an it, well, it that's that much easier. So Robin, to get back to her, you know, case for ki, which is ki, there's an Anishinaabe word that she was taught that essentially means earth being, and it ends with that ki. So ki, ki, is an abbreviation that sort of means a living being or an earth being. And she proposes, instead of it, let's use ki. Oh, ki is flying through the sky. If we don't know what it is, or if we don't know what its gender is, let's say ki, that's an earth being. And I think that the importance of that is that not everybody has to use ki or make that transition or shift, but just to be aware of the way that we objectify the world and how much easier it is once we've objectified the world to then abuse the world, essentially, to do what we want with it, to not ask permission, to not say please and thank you, to bring it back to sort of childhood lessons of just politeness and respect, right? When we're engaging with other creatures, other entities that have pronouns that we recognize as subjective, that is a he, she, they, then we're more likely to treat those other creatures with some measure of respect. So that's Robin's case that she's making, is that it's inherent to these indigenous languages, including her own, that other beings are alive and have agency and intentionality. And that really, that one very simple thing, if you think about it, can really revolutionize one's perspective. The other thing you asked about was concentric ecology, which is another indigenous scholar, a fellow named Enrique Salmon. So Enrique is an ethnobotanist, and his people are the Tarahumara Indians in northern Mexico, and he periodically goes down there and meets with different folks and also does some research. And he was really trying to capture what he saw on the ground there about what happens for his, and what are the relationships between his people and a particular really important plants like corn, which is essential to the culture and is considered a mother. Kin, right? Mother. These relationships are not confined, you know, to between human beings. And so he came up with this term, concentric ecology, to describe the ways in which people, human beings, can become keystone species in their landscapes, meaning that their actions, their work with the plants and the animals of that landscape can actually create and facilitate more biodiversity. It can create and facilitate mutual flourishing between people and their place. And this is been shown in many, many different places. But this, capturing this by saying it's a concentric ecology is a way of saying that these relations, the way that people feel themselves to be relatives to these plants and animals, and the way that in their mythologies, their cosmologies, their cultures, their stories, that these are recognized and known as relatives, and they're related. And in Enrique's case, they're related sometimes to even specific points of the human developmental and growth, you know, say childhood, puberty, adulthood, old age. You know, there are different plants that correspond to these times. So it's very embedded and entwined with the culture. So this idea of a concentric ecology is that humans can be beneficial presences on their landscapes because they are tied in to acknowledge their relationships, their deep relationships to these places. So that's the idea of concentric ecology. And that was sort of also a pillar of this series, because broadly speaking, I think that the work that we try to bring together is that we hear a lot every day, and in part, this is just the 24/7 news cycle. You know, we hear a lot about the damage that human beings are doing. And without ignoring that capacity, that destructive capacity that we have, which is been heightened in scale by the technologies available to us and the sort of nation state that we live within, that there are many other stories about the ways in which people relate to their landscapes in this sort of concentric way. And that these are situations in which human beings are actually, they benefit the places that they're a part. They make them more beautiful. They make them, ecologically speaking, healthier, and more resilient. And so that the idea then is that we, if we are adapted to our places, and if we are relating well to our more than human kin, then we can actually create flourishing where we are, that we aren't simply defiling of what we touch. In fact, for most of human history, I would venture that that has not been the case. And so it's kind of finding our way back into these practices and into these stories. And I think that a key component of that is this idea of kinning, and this idea of seeing ourselves as kin.
So a related question. So we are speaking, I guess it's November 12th, 2021. We are on the back end of another spike in the COVID-19 pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic makes some appearances in these volumes. So I guess my question is, hopefully at some point we're in a post-COVID-19 world, at least in the way that we've been experiencing it, it may linger. But how can we encourage, if, you know, assuming we want to encourage kinning, like how can we encourage kinning, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in, you know, our relationships with the natural world or other species? Are there sort of new possibilities that you or any, you know, particular contributor sort of identified or has identified since the publication for how we can sort of embrace this idea of kinning, especially at this sort of time of global transition?
Yeah, I'm thinking of an article that was sent to me the other day by Braun, in fact. It was about Singapore. And I don't know a ton about Singapore, but I know that they've, as an urban area, they've tried to incorporate green buildings, green walls, you know, restore their parks and green spaces, really kind of weave into the fabric of the, you know, sort of the call it the gray infrastructure, you know, weave the blue and the green in as well. And I think it's, I have to double check on this, or you might double check. I want to say it's otters, that river otters that are, have taken a little bit of advantage of this, that their numbers were down for a while and now they're rebounding, and rebounding to such a degree that, you know, people are following their different family groups on Facebook, like they would the Lannisters on Game of Thrones, you know, or, you know, like the different, the soap opera of otter life. I guess I'm reminded of that because in some cases, well, I think in so many cases, really, you know, I mean, one of the incredible things about COVID, I don't know what I would have done if it would have been, you can't go outside. But, and in fact, you know, as long as you were socially distanced, you know, that was the sort of safe place to be, to breathe, as long as you had the elbow room to do so. And you're right that, you know, it's a shock to, sort of business as usual. I think, you know, within that, as anytime there is that kind of shock, it's also, there's an opportunity to sort of take stock. And, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, turned to the sort of microwaves that they could connect to others, you know, whether that be gardening on their balcony or, you know, taking walks in their local parks, you know, and just because there was less socializing, at least offline, in groups and gatherings, and there were still plenty of opportunities to be out and about and connect. So I don't know. My experience was it didn't diminish the opportunity for connection, just put the emphasis in different places. Yeah, I guess that's where I'll leave it, unless you have a follow-up on that.
No, I guess the piece that you mentioned on Singapore, I think I read a maybe related or slightly different piece where I think certain sort of sea animals were so abundant in the River Thames in, you know, in London, the stretch that hits London. So they're like Londoners were seeing, you know, animals they haven't seen since before the river was so polluted that really no life could be sustained for stretches of time. So I don't know if that's connected, but that's what that reference made me think of. There was like a picture that looked like a seal on the like banks of the Thames. It probably wasn't a seal given the location, but maybe it was. I don't know. Maybe well, it was. I know that one there was a river otters.
I mean, I know that early on there's a mixed bag of that where like some of them were like doctored images and some of them were, you know, but, you know, if you look beyond the kind of fake, you know, the fake out, there is this desire, I think that expresses that we'd like to connect, you know, and we'd like these fellow creatures to be released from all of the pressures that they've, that they felt as a result of human presence. And, you know, but I, as somebody who has, you know, I mean, I devoted a book to urban life and interaction with other species in urban areas. Oftentimes, you know, what might be in our mind, something that is urban areas have long been characterized as the kind of, a kind of anti-nature. And I think that narrative is changing, but there are plenty of examples of where you don't have to go far to experience wildness in an urban area. And so oftentimes it's more a matter of our own perception than it is of the actual the actual places that we live in. And to, you know, that we are surrounded by and infused with, you know, the natural world. I mean, I guess there's overlap here in a certain sense, because we are as connected as our very next breath, which is sort of the kind of an original source of the model of reciprocity, right? We breathe in, you know, what the plants, the trees are offering, and we breathe out and share our breath with them. So, you know, from the dandelion growing up through the crack in the pavement to the backyard garden, to the local park, to the lakeshore or the seashore or the, you know, the pond or the vacant lot or the, you know, the peregrine falcons re-inhabiting skyscrapers in Chicago, you know, as nesting sites. You know, oftentimes it's more a matter of us, I think, opening our eyes to those experiences. And it's kind of, there's sort of a positive feedback loop in that the more we open ourselves, the more we end up seeing, and the more we end up seeing, the more we open ourselves. So.
Sure. So you have anticipated my next question. I've previously listened to a New Books interview of yours with your co-editor, John Hausdorfer, on your book on wildness. So clearly there's some connections that you've already highlighted between this book on kinship and your previous book on wildness, but I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about it. It's not lost on me that you know, this argument that I think you are sort of a part of is connected back to this, you know, William Cronin essay, I would argue at least, on the trouble with wilderness. And I think, you know, that essay has been used in some unanticipated ways, but I think you are part of sort of the pushback with Cronin that wildness is all around us. Wilderness as like legally defined may not be, but like wilderness in sort of a broader sense absolutely is, if we care to look at it, if we, you know, don't sort of pave over it. So any connections between kinship and wildness you would like to highlight that you haven't already?
Yeah, just that, along the lines of what you, what we were talking about earlier, though, in a slightly different context, you know, I'm going to go back to that phrase, a difference of degree and not of kind. In other words, a difference in quantity or depth of experience, but not necessarily in quality of experience. In that, when we did the book Wildness, we said, you know, that wildness is on a continuum from the most densely populated areas to those areas that, as you say, are zoned as wilderness areas that are very sparsely populated, if at all, by human beings, depending on sort of their legal designation and what's allowed to happen there. And so I think the tendency is to think, oh, well, you know, I want to have a quote unquote nature experience, so I better get in my car and drive outside of the city limits, preferably into one of these sort of monumental, you know, jewels of the national park system, like a Glacier National Park or a Yellowstone National Park. And that's where I can have a true nature experience. And we wanted to say, well, that's part of the continuum. That's, you know, part of, and there are different experiences to be had there, you know, when you're overwhelmed by a, you know, 1,000-foot cliff face, you know, with a waterfall pouring off of it into, you know, a beautiful, you know, lake below or something, as opposed to, you know, when you're walking down city alleyway. But the city alleyway is also part of the continuum, in that there is wildness all around. If we define wildness as a process, a sort of the land's the will that's connected to it etymologically speaking, that wildness, you know, is about will dior, and that is a process that's a part of us, like literally a part of us. Like our gut microbiomes are wild universes that are now being studied, and many connections being made between gut health and all the microbes that live within us and our brain health, our psychological health. And so it kind of circles back to the idea that we divided these kinship volumes by scale, you know, from the cosmic, you know, on down through various scales. And in the same way, there's a maybe a parallel there with the idea that wildness as a quality, as a part of the land's will, crosses whatever landscape we're in. And so it's a matter more of attuning ourselves to those instances of wildness. And if we can, encouraging them. I'll give you an example of something I talk about, which is in the Midwest, you know, there's like 0.01% of the prairie that was originally, you know, there, the tall grass prairie. And there's a lot of, Illinois itself is the motto is the prairie state, which is kind of embarrassing now, given how little prairie there is left. But at the same time, there are these restoration projects where people are reseeding, you know, the prairie. They're reclaiming lands or building on what remnant prairie is left to expand that. Growing the seeds to be cultivated again into those areas, or sometimes just allowing the land to again be what it was, sort of related to what we were talking about before. Once the pressures of pavement and other, you know, anthropogenic sources are removed, what does the land want to be? What does it want to do? And how do we align ourselves with that will? How do we listen deeply to that? How do we become conversation partners rather than monologists when we're interacting with the land? And so it doesn't mean always having the answers, but it means going in and listening as though there is agency there that needs to be heard. And that is wildness. That's tuning into wildness. What does this place want to be given the chance? So that's, you know, something that we certainly wanted to lift out in that book, that wildness was about depth and place, but it was also across a continuum, and that we didn't have to, that part of thinking of nature as always out there somewhere else, always kind of in these monumental landscapes, actually can inhibit the way that we think of humans as able to be part of their places.
Yeah, as you were talking, it occurred to me there's I think another connection that you touched on, sort of the nouning versus verbing. Right? Like wilderness is a noun. It suggests that there's this sort of static place that we call the wilderness, that we've designated these areas within this country, at least, but wildness or wilding or rewilding or, you know, reclaiming prairie land, right? That's an active process. That is something that I think acknowledges that as much as humans may want sort of a steady state, that one, we don't have that control. And two, that's not the case. So yeah, I think your nouning verbing conversation in these volumes, I think is another connection that didn't occur to me while reading, but while talking with you, that seems like a strong connection. So we're coming close to the end. I recognize your time is important, and you have other things to do with your day. But I have two more questions. So and this is more of a logistical one. There are a lot of people who wrote for these volumes, right? It started as one volume. It ended as five. I think by my count, it's somewhere around 800, 850 pages. I think you sent me a document that said this is some bananas amount of words. So how did you put this project together with Robin Wall Kimmerer, with John Hausdorfer? How did you approach your contributors? And like, what was your ask of them, right? Was it simply, hey, can you write something about kinship? Or was there something more specific that I think led to this, what I would say is like a creative burst of this, you know, collective mosaic that I think really works together and the pieces work really well separately?
So I'm glad you asked that. It's one of the nice things about working for an organization like the Center for Humans and Nature is that we're able, at least in pre-COVID times, we were able to get people together for meetings on occasion when we were beginning a project like the Kinship Project. And so it started out fairly modestly. You know, I think we had 15 to 20 people that we were able to come and meet as a group for a couple of days. And in part, that was just to share ideas. You know, there's a little bit of sharing kind of methods. You know, what do we think would be the best format to get this out into the world? You know, you might know that we also have a radio show associated with the Kinship books. We also have an online art gallery that has just been released in the past few months. So it's kind of a multidimensional project, but it started with a kind of core group of people. And then, you know, based on what they suggested, who they suggested, what topics they were keenest to want to focus on, we moved from there. And yeah, there are one of the things I'm really proud of these books is the way that we were able to get an international group of contributors, a couple of people from India, New Zealand, Australia, Germany, the UK, and just a wide diversity of people. So topically, you know, sometimes we knew kind of what hole we wanted to fill, but other times it was more a matter of we knew what person we wanted and knew that they would tell an interesting story no matter what they were writing about. And you asked about, you know, what kind of framing did we give folks? And so the easiest thing to do is just look on the back cover of each volume, because each of the volumes has a framing question on the back. And essentially, that's what we would ask our contributors. So just to give you an example, I happen to have the volume 3 partners in my hands. And the framing question was, how do cultural traditions, narratives, and mythologies shape the ways in which we relate to other beings as kin or not? How do these relations between and among different species foster a sense of responsibility and belonging? So by framing it as a question, you know, our contributors could mull that over, see where that intersected with their own work, their own experiences. And then as editors, you know, we would sometimes work with people to think about what might be the most relevant or the most exciting piece, that topic that they wanted to write about. But other times, you know, we left it in the hands of contributors to write their story, and then we'd see it on the other side and, you know, figure out if it did fit in the volume we thought they were going to fit in, or if we should shuffle things around a little bit, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. But overall, just super, super pleased with the breadth and the range of creativity and the different ways that people approach this same, you know, word and topic from so many different angles. And hopefully that gives the readers of these volumes a way to see where that intersects with their own life, or what that shows them that they hadn't even thought about before.
Great. Thank you. As I've said on previous podcasts, often we talk about books, but we don't actually hear language from the books that we've discussed. I've asked you if you would to read, I guess, the opening paragraph and the last two paragraphs of your introductory essay of volume 1. I think it sort of sets the table for what follows. So thank you.
Okay. Sure thing, Birdie. All right. So this introduction is called what we've been talking about, kinning. introducing the kinship series. The lines hung lightly suspended in midair, twinkling, illuminated from within, then vanished. I inclined my head. The lines reappeared, seeming to materialize out of emptiness. These weren't merely lines. They were radial strands precisely strung from a central axis, intricately woven. The glow from a nearby street lamp caught within them, revealing a sacred geometry. I leaned closer. With a slight tilt of my face, altering the angle between my eyes and the spider's evening project, the lines alternately disappeared or disclosed themselves. Their creator, deftly putting the finishing touches on this work of body art, was smaller than my thumbnail. Her handiwork sparkled with its own radiance. For a moment, I felt envious, then grateful. The craft on display demonstrated skills of which I was completely and utterly incapable. I drew in closer to get a better look at the stitching, which would likely hang for the evening before being pulled apart by a strong morning wind. Humans will survive and continue to tell our stories if we learn how to live well with our kin. The voices included in these volumes, these webs of words, and the collective wisdom they express invite us into this kind of kinning. These are the stories of how to listen to voices other than our own. Lean a little closer into the firelight. Up on the ceiling of the cave, or near the street lamp, or between branches in the forest, or in the corner of the room within which you are currently reading, a web may be flashing in a flicker of light.
That was Gavin Van Horn, co-editor of Kinship, Belonging in a World of Relations. Thank you, Gavin, for reading and for this interview and for your work. And please thank John Hausdorfer and Robin Wall-Kimmer, your co-editors.